Fake news goes global today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump likes to call critical press fake news, and other world leaders are following his lead.
There are lots of dictators and would-be authoritarians who now dismiss their opponents as fake news because, you know, the American president can do it now, so can we.
Plus, looking around, it's hard to grasp the scope of the California wildfires.
I should be able to see this beautiful mountain range, but it's completely blocked from view by all the smoke in the air from all the fires. So all in all, just a very spooky feel here.
And why are so many people going gaga over Bitcoin?
Gold doesn't come with a teleporter, whereas Bitcoins can be sent through the internet peer-to-peer in seconds.
The stories plus a love song of the Atlantic cod. You won't want to miss that today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Good to have you with us. Have you read 1984 lately? George Orwell's dystopian novel introduced us to doublethink, the notion that a person can accept two contradictory beliefs as true at the same time. For example, characters in 1984 could believe both that democracy was impossible and that the party was the guardian of democracy. I thought about that today when I heard the news from Poland. The ruling party there has been using the term fake news to attack its critics in the media. And today the government took that a step further. It issued a fine of over $400,000 against a U.S.-owned independent news channel, TVN24, arguing the channel's coverage of anti-government street protests had encouraged illegal activities.
And it sounds as shocking in Polish as it sounds in English. I mean, it's unprecedented.
That's Washington Post columnist Anne Applebaum in London. She closely follows the news from Poland.
The government disliked the way that this television channel portrayed some demonstrations that were actually a year ago now. They decided that the portrayal of anti-government demonstrators somehow violated the law or was against the national interest. It is quite shocking because it represents a new way to intimidate journalists. The government has decided it can fine people for political reasons, and that is very shocking.
And we should point out, this is a key point of this whole story, is that TVN24 is U.S. owned.
Yes. If it had been a private station, well, then we would have said, well, it's the government trying to intimidate the Polish owner. In this case, we have to wonder if it's the government trying to intimidate the American owner or persuading them to sell. This channel is owned by Scripps. It's actually the biggest U.S. investment in Poland. It's a multi-billion dollar investment, I should say, because it's not just the news channel. It's many other things as well, food channels and entertainment channels and so on. Scripps owns it, and Scripps has just been bought by Discovery Channel. And so the question is Discovery Channel going to be intimidated by this? Will they sell off this TV station? Will they end their support for independent media in Poland? Or will they, on the contrary, ask the U.S. ambassador and the U.S. government to back them up and to protest against this outrageous decision?
Did the Polish government ever use the phrase fake news in describing any of this stuff?
They certainly accuse their opponents of making up stories. I mean, it's a complicated story in Poland because Poland has a government channel, a state channel, which used to be fairly bland and neutral. You know, it had been remodeled along the lines of the BBC. And over the past year, it has been remade by the ruling party into a very angry and narrow propaganda channel, which itself propagates false stories on a kind of stunning scale. I mean, for example, there's a film clip and some photographs of some Polish judges, and the judges are at the center of the controversy, who were filmed coming out of a building near the Polish parliament. And the building is where the opposition party has its headquarters. As it turned out, the judges were in that building because there's also a cafeteria there, a restaurant, and they were drinking coffee. But the clip has been shown over and over and over again on state television as proof that the judges are somehow collaborating with the opposition.
How split is the Polish public about what to believe?
Very split. In a weird way, Poland has politics that are, I think, more similar to American politics than almost any other country right now, in that people live in completely different echo chambers. They have not just different opinions about what's going on in their country. They have different facts. And the government news is now totally politicized. It's very slanted. The opposition news is better in that it tries to report based on things that are actually happening. But, you know, we know the syndrome from our own country. People have become very angry. Even the opposition has trouble. People have trouble showing the government's point of view because what the government is doing is violating the Constitution and violating all the laws as we've known them hitherto.
And how much do you think Poland is taking a cue from the Trump White House on the fake news kind of idea?
I think very much so. I mean, I think the idea that it's okay to not just push back against media, but to criticize, to punish, and to try and ban critical media. I think that the fact that the U.S. president now does that, and he is very much, you know, somebody who's followed and whose moves are watched carefully in Poland, you know, makes a big difference. It affects people in Poland quite a lot. It's one of the other things that gives them this feeling of carte blanche that they can even attack a U.S. Media company.
Have you seen other countries in Europe kind of testing the fake news thing to see if it works for their own ends?
It's now common all over the world. I mean, you can hear it in the Philippines. You can hear it in Burma. There are lots of dictators and would-be authoritarians who now dismiss their opponents as fake news because, you know, the American president can do it now, so can we.
Anne Applebaum with The Washington Post speaking with us from London. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sometimes fake news is so ridiculous, it's easy to recognize, like that phony list of catering requirements for Trump's trip to the Mideast last May. 8 Hungry Man chicken dinners just for his hotel suite, but only KFC paper napkins? I mean, really. But fake news can also be subtle and harder to detect. And if adults can have a hard time spotting fake news, how do children do? Beth Hewitt is a senior lecturer in media practice at Salford University in the UK. She led a project that partnered with her colleagues at BBC Newsround to study how well children aged 9 to 14 can spot false information.
Young people are actually really, really savvy about the theory of fake news. So they've heard the term, they understand it, they can debate it. But actually putting it all into practice is very difficult. But I think one of the other things that we also discovered along the way is that the adults find it hard as well. So it's not really a surprise that young people struggle to spot the fake news.
Did you spot any trends with kids, like when they generally recognize fake news and when they struggle to see fake news?
I mean, we looked at this very much within the context of social media. So they're getting a lot of their information through Snapchat, through Instagram. And it's at those moments when they probably don't recognize the fake news. We found two things around age, actually. One is that the young people and children who we talked to who'd actually had lessons, digital literacy lessons, were much more savvy than the ones who didn't. So if you have an 8-year-old who's had those lessons and you get an 11-year-old who hasn't, actually the 8-year-old might be much more able to decipher and work out the fake news than the 11-year-old. Mm. Age is important, but it's not the only criteria.
So in this group of 9 to 14-year-olds, where are these kids seeing their news? Is it online or TV?
They're getting a lot of their information through social media. What we did notice is that younger people, one of the things that they'll tend to do is engage with news stories and share news stories in a way that perhaps we as adults don't. And all age groups between 80 and 90% said that they knew what fake news was. But that's one of the key things. You know, we asked them if they'd actually shared fake news unwittingly. As they got older, they were more sure that they probably had. The younger ones actually said, no, we haven't. No, we wouldn't do it. So as they got older, they were slightly wiser about the fact that they really might not have recognized fake news.
How can children be taught to recognize fake news? And I recognize by asking that question, I'm kind of asking for all of us, because it sounds like one of the takeaways is that younger people are more sophisticated than older people at this.
Yeah, I mean, I think like with so many things with young people, it's about having those discussions, both in the home, with the families, with the carers, and also within schools and colleges. So I know here in the UK, there's a lot of emphasis being put on digital literacy. And I think the way digital literacy will work, if it is to be successful, is it will be integrated into so many of those lessons and of those subject areas that it becomes part of their environment. After all, they live in that digital technological world. They need to know what they should be looking for if a piece of news is fake. You know, where are the sources? What's the URLs? Who's written it? What are the links within those pieces of news that you're reading? Where do the images come from? Those sort of things, if you equip young people with that, at least they've got the tools to be dealing with fake news. And yes, of course, it's attractive if they see, you know, a famous person in there or fantastic graphics and brilliant animation. But actually to be aware of where the information is coming from and to understand how you can verify your sources, then that will make sure that they can decipher it.
Hmm. Finally, Beth, did you sense that these kids understood what's at stake if you can't tell the difference between fake news and real news?
It's a really good question, Nat, and I think it's quite a complex question. I think they do understand what is at stake, but actually they are still very, very young and their world is still black and white. You know, developmentally, the grey areas haven't come to them really by the time they're 9 or 10. It's going to be far later when that happens. So I do think there's a worrying and there's a concerning aspect to all this, yeah.
Beth Hewitt, Senior Lecturer in Media Practice at Salford University in the UK. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, this happened today.
Здравствуйте, товарищи! Товарищи!
That's Vladimir Putin addressing Russian military personnel in Syria, effectively declaring mission accomplished. You'll recall that since the fall of 2015, Russia has been providing direct military support to the government of Bashar al-Assad. Charles Maines is the world's eyes and ears in Moscow. Correct me if I'm wrong, Charles, but has Putin done this before with Syria, basically saying mission accomplished?
You're not wrong, Marco. He tried to do this last year, in fact, and declared mission accomplished. He said he was soon troops would be coming home. But the situation on the ground just kept shifting that they weren't able to do that. You know, they couldn't face this idea of having gone in and then having Assad lose the war ultimately to other forces. So they stuck around. And this time, I think they feel as though they've finally now destroyed these other forces that are in opposition to Assad. I think that they feel as though the time is right to try and make this shift over to some sort of negotiated peace settlement.
So no takebacks this time. Russia has built up a significant naval base in Syria, providing the Russian Navy with its only base in the Mediterranean. No one is expecting them to give that up, are they?
No, although they will keep the base, although it sounds as though most of the troops will be coming home. I think it's unclear at this point just how many numbers will stay. Putin made clear today that should the need arise, certainly Russia was ready to return back to these bases and redeploy. But, you know, I think ultimately, you know, from Russia's perspective, this whole campaign has just displayed Russia's restored influence in the Middle East. And it's certainly come at a moment, as it's perceived by many in the Middle East, that the U.S. is pulling back.
Charles, why did Putin send Russian troops to Syria in the first place?
Well, Russia came into this with multiple goals. Ostensibly, it was to take the fight to ISIS and fight them in Syria rather than at home. That was the main goal. But on the other hand, Russia had some alternative goals as well. From the very beginning, if you remember back to the start of the campaign a little over 2 years ago, Russia was isolated internationally. You know, the intervention into Syria was essentially to force other world powers, including the U.S., to deal with the Kremlin. And also Assad, the Syrian leadership, was Moscow's sole ally in the region. And this was a way for them to promote and protect their footprint in the Middle East. And since, of course, it's grown under the last 2 years. And then finally, I think it was also a little bit about Russia flexing its muscles. You know, a lot of people didn't think that they could sustain an air and sea campaign. And it really played into Putin's image as having rebuilt Russia's army into a strong, capable force.
And we should remember, too, that in 2015, Obama was president. Did Putin have kind of a belief that he would be able to succeed in Syria where the Americans had not?
Well, I think there was no small satisfaction taken, certainly, that that Obama said it couldn't be done. If you remember, Obama once famously predicted as Russia went in, this would be a quagmire, that the Russians would, and Putin in particular, would regret this decision. I'm not so sure that they do at this point. I mean, it's not to say that they haven't had setbacks along the way, but largely, at least from the political perspective, from the Kremlin's perspective, has been largely successful.
All right. So you'd step away from what the Kremlin says. What kind of impact has the Russian intervention had on the course of the war in Syria?
Well, you know, it's done several things. I mean, personally, they changed the fortunes of the Syrian leadership. Bashar al-Assad was essentially a teetering regime before the Russians came in, and they saved him.
Yeah, so what has Putin actually going to Syria, making this kind of mission accomplished statement to the Russian troops there? How is this being seen back in Moscow today?
Well, it's certainly being portrayed in state media as a triumph. And I think you'll probably see a hero's welcome for these soldiers as they come back back to Russia. And it certainly plays well to the tableau of Putin announcing his candidacy for the presidency and making himself look, of course, much more presidential than and much more Russia's national leader than his opponents in the race.
The World's Charles Maines in Moscow. Thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
Trickle down abroad. Has it worked? That's next on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. The GOP tax bill in Congress relies heavily on so-called trickle-down economics. The idea is that tax breaks for corporations and the wealthy would lead to investment and growth, and that the benefits would then trickle down to everyone. It's been a much debated topic here for a long time, but has trickle-down economics ever worked well for other countries? We asked the world's Jason Margolis to look into that.
In the late 1970s, Ireland's economy was struggling, so they decided to cut business taxes dramatically. Ireland also increased individual taxes, including rates on the middle class. The idea was that stronger businesses would benefit everyone. It worked.
For the following 25 years, they had really rapid economic growth and went from being the poorest country in Europe to one of the richest. It really did help everybody.
Economist James Hines is a tax specialist at the University of Michigan.
Now, Ireland was a very specific situation, and the question is whether that kind of lesson would apply to the United States.
Hines says that's debatable. The United States isn't Ireland 40 years ago.
Unemployment is very low in America right now. Also, when Ireland cut their business taxes, they did it in a very smart way. They targeted it to foreign manufacturing firms initially because they thought that they would get the greatest economic benefits from that rather than kind of across-the-board cuts. And Ireland coupled that with a lot of other very sensible policies that they enacted at the same time.
Hines doesn't see anything close to this type of methodical, deliberate policymaking from the current Republican tax proposals.
It seems that a lot was cobbled together just to try to get passage.
So have broad tax cuts been tried by other countries to help an already robust economy? I reached out to a handful of tax specialists to pose that question, including author David K. Johnston.
No, I don't. I'm not aware. That doesn't mean there isn't, but I'm not aware of such an example.
One free market economist I spoke with came up with Margaret Thatcher's Britain in the 1970s and the Baltic states after the fall of the Soviet Union as strong foreign examples. But the Baltic states were radically transforming from socialism to capitalism at the time, and the UK's tax reforms delivered mixed results to an economy that was struggling 40 years ago. Again, that's not the situation in the U.S. today, says Johnston.
Corporations are sitting on record amounts of cash. If you have an adequate supply of capital, why in the world would you want to do things to encourage a more adequate supply of capital?
And Johnston isn't an outlier in criticizing today's Republican tax plans. The University of Chicago polled 38 prominent economists across the ideological spectrum. Only one said proposed tax cuts would yield, quote, substantially higher economic growth. And remember, unlike Ireland in the 1970s, the U.S. in 2017 is part of a much more interconnected global economy. And if U.S. taxes go down, the dollar should get stronger.
Rising dollar could provide a headwind to the economy.
Michael Klein is an economist with the Fletcher School at Tufts University. He explains that if the dollar gets stronger, it's going to make it harder for American companies to export.
So this one goal of having a lot of tax cuts is going to be at odds with another goal of trying to move the trade deficit closer to balance.
And that means that tax cuts might not boost the economy quite the way Republicans are promising. Remember those 38 economists? All of them said the current tax overhaul will make the long-term debt substantially higher. Now, all of this isn't to say that economists think tax reform is unnecessary. Far from it. Again, James Hines.
We needed to fix the U.S. business tax system to make it more like other countries, to make the United States more competitive.
Politicians on both sides of the aisle tend to agree with this. In fact, President Obama tried to lower the corporate tax rate. But Hines says Congress is missing an opportunity and making hamburger meat out of the details.
If you have a sensible tax reform combined with other sensible government policies, then you can usually get a pretty good response. The question in America in 2017 is that what we're getting?
For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Still on the economy tip, you can speculate on gold, on euros, and now on Bitcoin. The first ever Bitcoin futures started trading yesterday on a regulated U.S. exchange, the Chicago Board Options Exchange. The price of the virtual currency has soared in recent weeks, and so far it appears investors believe Bitcoin will continue to rise in value. Some also see futures trading as a sign that Bitcoin is creeping into the mainstream. But there are skeptics. Here's what Paul Donovan, chief global economist at Swiss banking giant UBS, told our colleagues at the BBC.
Just introducing a futures contract doesn't legitimize anything, frankly. It shows there's interest, and absolutely there's interest. There's always interest in a bubble. That's the defining characteristic of a bubble, is you suck people into it.
For more on what all of this means and whether there is a Bitcoin bubble, we called up Peter von Valkenburg. He's with the Coin Center in Washington, D.C. That's a nonprofit that looks at public policy issues raised by digital currencies like Bitcoin. So, Peter, Bitcoin futures trading, how big a deal is this?
I mean, I think it's a big deal in that it allows institutional investors to start putting bets on the technology, basically. And I think more people looking at it, more money making trades, will lead to a better understanding of the long-term value proposition of the technology.
Futures are typically based on the price of a real commodity like gold and oil. How does it work with Bitcoin, given that it's virtual and not something you can put your actual fingers on?
I mean, it's true. It's a digital commodity rather than a normal physical world one, but they basically operate just the same. So just like gold or platinum, there's only so many Bitcoins that exist in the world. Just like gold or platinum, you can trade them peer-to-peer. So I can hand you a gold bar. I can send you a Bitcoin on your phone. The one difference, and this is actually a lot of where the value proposition comes from, I think, is that gold doesn't come with a teleporter, whereas Bitcoins can be sent through the internet peer-to-peer in seconds. You try and get a lump of platinum over to China, it's going to take a little while. You can't do it through the internet.
So this is Bitcoin's debut on a major U.S. exchange. What do you think is going to happen?
It's really hard to know. There's a lot of new enthusiasm that is bringing in a lot of new institutional investors, which is why the price is moving so aggressively, I'd say, because you've got big money coming in compared to the old school retail investors or retail purchasers. But that easy come, easy go, potentially. Mm-hmm. So we've seen an exponential increase in the price. We could see a cliff, or maybe it keeps going up. I try not to make predictions, especially about the future.
Well, I was going to say, exponential increases, new enthusiasm. I mean, I want to ask you the B question, like, is Bitcoin sitting on a bubble?
It is possible. So I think there's a lot of similarities in our community, in the cryptocurrency open blockchain community, and the .com technology community back in the 90s. In that there are some fundamental world-changing innovations taking place that will have lasting consequences in the form of a few successful projects, like Google was successful, like Facebook was successful. But there's also so much noise, so many projects out there that are just riding on the hype, just like companies were riding on the hype of being a .com, buying Super Bowl ads and having sock puppets.
Are the bets right now on Bitcoin that there will be a pop to the bubble, or that it'll just keep on growing?
Well, the bets are the futures market, so you can look at the price right now, which is higher than the active price. So right now, the bet is no pop, at least not in the short and medium term.
Peter von Valkenburg, Director of Research at Coin Center, speaking with us from Washington. Thanks very much, Peter.
Yeah, thanks, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman. A former Marine got drunk one night, pulled out his rifle, and fired on a mosque.
I was a hater. Look at my Facebook. I was an actual hater.
But members of the mosque reached out and forgave him.
And then just spending some time with him, you realize, oh, I was terribly wrong.
Finding common ground in Connecticut. Still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. My routine for the past few days has been wake up and check for updates on California, hoping that the fires and the wind have died down. I can only imagine what it looks and feels like, but California, I'm thinking about you. And since I'm in Boston, here's something else I'm thinking about. A few years ago, we got hit by three big rapid-fire blizzards here, and we learned that when public transportation shuts down, it's often people in the lower rungs of the economy who end up risking their jobs because they can't get to work. Same could be happening in one California community that's under threat from a massive fire right now, the small oceanside city of Carpinteria. Saul Gonzalez with station KCRW in Santa Monica joins us. He's on Carpinteria Beach right now. Saul, tell us what you're seeing.
Well, it's kind of spooky, Marco, because there's no one on the beach, first off. The skies are this milky, kind of ugly, milky white from all the smoke coming off of the fires. I should be able to see this beautiful mountain range, but it's completely blocked from view by all the smoke in the air from all the fires.
Have you been in the town, and what sort of damage have you seen?
Yeah, I was on the edge of the fire line early this morning. Not a lot of residences have been affected in the community itself, but when you get further inland into the ravines and the canyons, yeah, there are some structures that have burned. There are nurseries that were threatened, avocado farms. This is a part of the Southern California coastline that is kind of a throwback to the way California's coastline used to be 40, 50 years ago, a lot more like agriculture coming up almost to the sand, really, in some places. So that's what a lot of people were particularly concerned about how it might, you know, affect the nursery business and the agricultural industry here in this part of the state. But fortunately, what I saw this morning, firefighters were pretty much holding the fire outside of the community and along the ridges. But it was still a very impressive sight, particularly before the sun came up with the mountain sort of cast in this fiery glow.
So tell us about some of the people you've been speaking to, like maybe some of those mission-critical workers at the nursery.
Well, you know, just driving around town, I would see just sort of groups of guys hanging out like on street corners and sort of looking at the fire. And I stopped and started talking to some of them. And immigrant agricultural workers, I mean, people who work in those nurseries and people who work in those avocado groves who weren't able to get into work today because of road closures, or they were told by their bosses, listen, the air quality is so terrible, you just can't work today, so stay home or do something else and check back later.
One of the people you spoke with is a man named Juan Hernandez. He does landscape work in and around Carpinteria.
Como ahora estuve con unos muchachos ahí ahorita. Dice, no, dice, lo que pasa es que el patrón no nos va a pagar.
So what he's saying, Marco, is essentially is, you know, when he doesn't work and other immigrant workers like him don't work, then they don't make a living that day. And I think that's really a part of the story that doesn't get a lot of attention. You know, we get a lot of natural catastrophes here in Southern California, our earthquakes, of course, the fires and mudslides. And often the people who are most vulnerable to these kind of catastrophes is the immigrant workforce. It's the people who kind of live in the shadows that make Southern California run. But they're also essential to efforts to reconstruct things. So I'm sure in the coming days and weeks, there's going to be a lot of work for immigrant Southern Californians on home projects, on, you know, reconstruction projects, things like that. That's inevitably what happens in Southern California and, of course, in so many other parts of the country with a lot of immigrants.
Our friend Saul Gonzalez from KCRW Santa Monica in Carpinteria, California. Saul, stay safe and thank you.
Hey, thank you, Marco.
Over to Germany now, where there's still no new government more than 2 months after an inconclusive national election. One of the big sticking points in talks between the governing conservatives and rival parties has been coal. The country says it's committed to phasing out coal use to meet its promise to cut global warming pollution, but the parties have not been able to agree on when. Still, Germany has already made a major decision about a big part of its coal industry. It's closing down the last of its underground mines. Next year. That means the end of a once mighty industry in Germany. But for the last of Germany's underground coal miners, it'll be a pretty soft landing. From our Livable Planet desk, here's reporter Valerie Hamilton.
Ernst Müller is taking it pretty easy on the job these days. He's in charge of the machine shop at the Prosper Haniel coal mine in western Germany's Ruhr Valley, and today he's showing me around. Coal mines have anchored the economy here for 150 years, but that's all over now. Germany's last underground coal mines are set to close next year, and things are winding down. So there's plenty of time for a coffee break. We head past a black hill of coal and under a conveyor belt to Müller's workshop. Inside, it's like a museum. Tools and spare parts line the back edge of a big wooden workbench, and there's an ancient-looking drill press in the corner. We sit down at a long table with a lot of empty chairs. When Müller started at Prosper Haniel 17 years ago, there were 5 people in the machine shop. Now he's alone.
17 Jahre bin ich jetzt hier und seit 7-8 Jahren alleine.
Over a really good cup of coffee, he tells me about his plans for the future. He's 57, and under a downsizing plan, he could have already retired. Instead, he's sticking around for a couple more years to help close the mine. Then, he says, he's thinking about moving to live off of his pension on the Mediterranean resort island of Mallorca. If this sounds a little different from what you're used to hearing about coal mines closing, well, it is. And the reason goes back decades. 60 years or so ago, coal was king in Germany. 500,000 people worked in the coal mines that fed the steel mills and power plants that rebuilt the country after the Second World War. But the industry peaked in the 1950s, and it's pretty much been sliding ever since, from a 1-2 punch of high costs and falling demand. A German state newsreel from 1966 shows coal miners already retraining for new jobs as electricians, metal workers, even masseurs. It looks fun on film, but it wasn't pretty. Thousands of people lost their jobs and took to the streets to protest. So the government stepped in. They consolidated the mining industry into one company, RAG, whose purpose would be to downsize carefully. Since then, RAG has closed more than 100 mines in what both sides call a socially conscious way.
It was not always perfect.
This is RAG spokesperson Christoph Beike.
But it was much better than in other regions, in England, in France, or in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
In 2016, coal mines in the U.S. laid off thousands of workers. When Prosper Haniel closes next year, it's laying off exactly none, thanks to longstanding agreements between RAG and labor unions.
Well, this is the difference between the United States and Germany. We know that a company lives only with its employees.
At Prosper Haniel, workers like Miller, with 20 years on the job, can retire early, paid by a company fund. About half of the younger workers can stay on to maintain the mine area after it closes. The rest get job placement and training.
We promise every miner to find a new job for him.
To be fair, that's easier here than in the U.S. Unlike a lot of American mining regions, this is an urban area with jobs in nearby cities like Cologne and Dusseldorf. The region has been building a post-coal economy for 50 years, and Mueller says co-workers have moved on to good jobs in energy, logistics, and retail. Mueller says he recently talked to a few of them, and they're all totally happy. Of course, closing mines isn't just about miners. Mueller says shutdowns can ripple through whole communities, taking down everything from bakeries to butcher shops. There's no retirement plan for workers down the supply chain who lose their jobs when the mine closes. In some of Germany's former mining cities, unemployment rates are still roughly twice the national average. Still, Mueller says the mine has done right by him and by his co-workers. He says when it's over, it's over. Now, coal in general is not over in Germany. It's just these underground mines that are closing. The country still mines a lot of cheaper surface coal, and it still imports a lot of hard coal from other countries. But it's under pressure to phase those out as well, to help the country live up to its promises to cut its climate pollution. And the country's experience downsizing coal workers like Ernst Mueller could help it ease that transition. As for Ernst Mueller, I wish him good luck and tell him I'm envious of his retirement plans.
Ja, muss nach Deutschland kommen. Im Amiland ist das nicht so, ne?
He tells me you should come to Germany, because it's not like that in America. For The World, Valerie Hamilton at the Prosper Haniel Coal Mine, Germany.
Tomorrow, we hear what one German city is doing to remake itself for life after coal. Okay, if you've been finding news from the human world stressful recently, and who can blame you, you might want to tune into an incredible series from our colleagues at the BBC. Blue Planet 2 has been more than a decade in the making and contains incredible footage of marine life from across the globe. But it's not just the images that have been painstakingly collected. The sounds are also pretty incredible. Professor of Marine Biology Steve Simpson of Exeter University was a sound recordist on the series, diving to eavesdrop, literally, on the oceans. Yeah, so, Professor Simpson, how big a part does sound play in marine environments? Because I typically think of the ocean as being, when I have my head underwater, pretty quiet.
That's right. So our ears don't work well underwater. And in fact, when Jacques Cousteau made his groundbreaking film 60 years ago, The Silent World, Le Monde des Silences, the assumption was that the oceans are silent. But we now know that whales produce incredibly evocative songs. Dolphins have their own names and can call those out to their family members. And fish produce a lot of sounds to defend territories or to attract and impress mates. Remember, all of these stunning images that you see on Blue Planet 2 generally are taken in the daytime when you can see. But at night, you're robbed of any visual cues, and so sound becomes essential for animals to find their way around and to be able to protect themselves.
So, Professor Simpson, we've got three samples of three different creatures recorded for Blue Planet 2. Let's have a listen and then just talk about them. Here's the first one. Okay, so what is that?
So that's an amazing sound. It was only recently recorded and identified to the actual fish making it. It's a small damselfish. It's not much to look at. Little yellow damselfish lives on coral reefs right through the Pacific Ocean. So you'd find them in Taiwan, but all the way down to the Great Barrier Reef. And what we think this fish has really evolved to be able to do is to produce these higher frequency whoop whoop kind of sounds. Mm. Most fish produce popping, deeper grumbling sounds. And by producing high frequency sounds, they've effectively got their own secret channel where no other animals are really interfering with their sound. So it gets them heard despite the backdrop of all the other animals communicating as well.
And in this case, getting heard because it's a mating ritual, is that what you said?
Well, these are quite territorial, the Ambon damselfish. So it could well be a male defending a territory. They tend to defend a nest site, which they attract the females. So either it's a defensive sound, a territorial sound, or it might then also be the sound that persuades the female that he's the one to come and deposit her eggs in his nest.
Okay, here's another sound. All right, I got to say, that does remind me of songs of the humpback whale or maybe dolphins. What is this?
Well, it is exactly. It is a humpback whale. It's just a beautiful song. Yeah.
Here's one more sample, Professor. All right, tell me what this is.
Well, isn't that just beautiful? It's actually a love song. It's the love song of the Atlantic cod.
Wow. The love song of the Atlantic cod. I don't think I'm going to be able to eat fish and chips again. So I've got to pick up on something you were talking about earlier. Do these sounds suggest these sea animals, at least of the same species, are communicating with each other?
Absolutely. I mean, we see communication in crustaceans, so in lobsters, in snapping shrimps. We certainly see lots of different fish that can communicate. So in the series, I was able to use a puppet predator to actually invoke some territorial and anti-predator behavior in clownfish.
What do you mean? Like you made a clownfish puppet?
Literally, no. Well, it was a grouper, so the predator of a clownfish. And I was able to swim around with these around a clownfish colony with my puppet and pretend to be that predator. By doing that, you could see the fish all suddenly turn very defensive. And a clownfish colony is an amazing thing in that you've got the largest fish is a mature female. She dominates the colony. And then you have one mature male and then a bunch of juveniles, all of which are different in size in a pecking order. And so what you see is that the fish all turn on guard. They start alarm calling to warn each other that there's a predator in the area. And then you can then pick up, as the fish retreat back into their anemone, the smaller fish giving out a few pops, presumably to indicate that they're still okay.
Steve Simpson, professor of marine biology at Exeter University. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Speaking there with the professor reminded me of a story we reported a few years ago about a research project that records the sounds of the deep ocean, like whales swimming by or the rumble of a far away earthquake. You can listen, too, over at PRI.org. Officials in New York City say today's rush hour explosion in a subway station was an attempted terrorist attack. Three people suffered minor injuries. The most seriously injured was a suspect who's now in custody. Police have identified him as an immigrant from Bangladesh. There's still a lot we don't know about what happened today, including whether religion had anything to do with it. One thing we do know, some people have used previous attacks or attempted attacks to confirm their assumptions that Islam is somehow inherently violent. That's something that a mosque in Connecticut has been actively trying to counter by engaging critics in conversation. Arthur Nazarian has a story from Meriden, Connecticut.
Tucked away in this quiet, leafy corner of New England, Bayt al-Aman Mosque lives up to its name as the House of Peace. Worshippers line up in rows in the maroon carpet in the main prayer hall. Luckily, the room was empty late on a Friday night 2 years ago. That's when several bullets from a high-powered rifle tore through the walls here.
The shots had been reportedly fired at 2 o'clock in the morning, so 4 hours after we had left. If I had stayed over for devotion, which sometimes we do, then we would have been right in the line of fire.
That's Zahir Manan, outreach director at the mosque. The walls are patched up now, but you can still see where the bullets went through them that night.
It was heartbreaking. We were shocked, and there were no words to describe it.
The police arrested a man living next door for firing the shots. He's a vet, a Marine, and his name is Ted Hagee.
I just kind of thought, well, if there's any extremists in there, if I fire some shots, because I knew they had cameras on there, it'll scare them. And, you know, that was Jack Daniels thinking that, you know, if there was any extremists there, they were going to, you know, think twice.
Hagee says he'd been drinking that night in November of 2015. He was angry. It was the same day as the deadly Paris attacks, which just made him more angry. He was already thinking that Muslims were a threat to America, and here they were in a mosque right next door to him.
I was like, yeah, let me, you know, fire off some rounds, you know. So the mosque is right next door to my house. There's little power lines between it. But I thought, you know, I put some rounds into the ground between there and had no idea that it was actually hit until, you know, the FBI raided my house.
Hagee was charged with a federal hate crime. He says some local Muslims hoped the mosque would press for the toughest punishment. But Zahir Manan says he came to a different conclusion after he met Hagee.
So when I first saw him, he's not walking in arrogance or pride. He's bending over a little bit, has red cheeks, teary eyes, and you can tell by his body language and his eyes that he's remorseful, he's sorry, this is against his character, you know, even before any words were said.
Manan and his community decided to forgive Hagee, who spent 6 months in prison. And over time, the two men became friends.
I was a hater. Look at my Facebook, I was an actual hater. And then just spending some time with him, you realize, oh, I was terribly wrong.
For Zahir Manan, dealing with critics is nothing new. He's part of the Ahmadiyya Muslim minority. Its members believe that a 19th century religious figure from India is the Messiah, and they face deadly persecution by other Muslims in places like Pakistan, where Manan's family is from. Manan says he's willing to engage with peaceful critics of his faith. In fact, he welcomes a debate, like the one he's been having for months now with a guy who lives 10 minutes down the road from the mosque.
People that have Muslim
now, memory. What my answer, and I think...
Manan is sitting on a green leather couch at the home of Tom Grimshaw. He's a 76-year-old retired engineer and a Donald Trump supporter. And ever since the September 11th attacks, he's been researching Islamic scripture in a serious way.
When they say Islamophobia, oh, well, that's just Islamophobia. No, I don't believe that. I can take them through the logic behind it.
But you just said a moment ago that, you also said a moment ago that Muhammad forbade the killing of women and children. He had rules of war 1,400 years ago.
What did I say, though? I said Islam core teachings ended when Muhammad, peace be upon him, died.
Grimshaw is on a personal mission to find out whether Islam is inherently violent.
We do have a basic disagreement here. There are things in the Quran itself that justify violence. No question about it, and I list those and go through all that.
It isn't so. The more intense he gets in his questioning and allegations, the more research I do, the more informed I become, as well as he becomes himself. So what happens is that, yeah, we go back and forth and we have a debate, but as I like to call it, a dignified dialogue. It's not against you or me or your demographic or my demographic.
It's the kind of open but tough conversation about Islam both men have been craving. But they say it never gets personal. It's about investigating what's at the core of the religion. Their plan is to distill these debates into something concrete. They're working on a book together.
So a lot of people in the general public would look at Tom and see a bigot who hates Islam and has an animus against your religion.
If that was true, he wouldn't be coming to our mosque so much, and he wouldn't call our mosque his church. And I wouldn't have gone to his house so many times. He wouldn't have gone to my house or my parents' house. The trust and the love that's between us, it's like between me and Tom is like a father and son. And we develop that through our dignified dialogue.
This is the kind of attitude that has allowed Zahir to make friends with people who were once foes, like Ted Hagee, the guy who fired at Zahir's mosque.
They had no fear. They just forgave me, and that was it. It was over, and they just wanted to educate me and be my friend. And when things go like that, you really have to look at yourself and say, hey, wait a minute, there's something more to Islam that I owe it to them and to myself to research this a little bit and find out what it really is about.
For The World, Arthur Nazarian, Meriden, Connecticut.
This wonderful voice belongs to Haitian folk singer and political activist Joseph Emmanuel Manu Charlemagne. He died yesterday at the age of 69, a remarkable artist and activist. But to the non-Creole speaker, Manu's tone masks the message of a lot of his songs. They may sound like and are often mistaken for love songs, but they're filled with wry and caustic lyrics that have, over the decades, taken on successive dictatorships in Haiti and questioned the class order there. This kind of musical commentary kept Manu in exile in Florida, but helped shape and influence politics in Haiti for much of the last century. Today, though, the beauty of his voice is not lost on us.
Mais c'est pas tout le monde qui jouit privilège ça. Gagnon série de mots, c'est pour yon catégorie yon existé.
That'll do it for us today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
Yo la ya vivo jour le jour.
PRI, Public Radio International.